Hi, this is Steve Nerlich.
Why cheap astronomy?
Yeah, why? And this is Dear Cheap Astronomy, episode 124, Aliens and Alien Worlds. Yep, it's aliens again, along with that ever-perplexing mystery that surely they're out there, even though there's no sign of them. But if they are out there, then what should we talk about? Dear Cheap Astronomy, is it true what they say about alien diplomacy? A recent paper by John Gertz, called Interstellar Diplomacy, suggests that some kind of contact with aliens is inevitable, which seems reasonable with respect to receiving some kind of radio transmission. But the paper then goes on to suggest that contact might involve a robotic scout vehicle sent here from a distant alien civilization, and then the paper descends into farce by further suggesting that such robotic scouts might have flown in our atmosphere already. You know, like those UAP things that the US Air Force and NASA are investigating. I mean, yikes. But anyway, if you can get past that bit, the paper does make some interesting points, and it's not completely implausible that an advanced civilization could send out scout vehicles to likely life-harboring stellar systems like ours. Or at least the scouts might cruise past such systems and stop for a closer look if they detect reruns of I Love Lucy. Anyway, if such a robotic scout did enter our solar system with some kind of dynamic AI aboard, then a two-way conversation could take place. It's assumed the alien AI will be able to figure out our language, if not languages, and also interpret the broader dynamics of our behaviour, including our enthusiasm for two-way conversations. The scout could then engage with us, and we with it, knowing that the scout would be relaying its findings about us back to its homeworld. So the implication is that we'd better make a good impression, and the paper optimistically proposes that whatever is said to the scout should be agreed to in advance by 3/4 of the United Nations. Well, maybe that could work if the aliens are far enough away that contact is only possible through large government-owned broadcasting antennae, like the 70-meter dishes of the Deep Space Network. But otherwise, it seems highly unlikely that everyone on Earth is going to agree to let the UN decide what to say to the aliens. And if you can just use a backyard transmitter, then it's almost inevitable that someone is going to send the aliens a picture of their butt. To avoid such an outcome, the paper proposes criminal charges and imprisonment should be the result of such unauthorized METI, that is, messaging extraterrestrial intelligences. Criminal charges and imprisonment does seem a little draconian, not to mention almost impossible to enforce, since you'd have to somehow weed out that one butt picture from the current cacophony of terrestrial radio noise that our planet is immersed in. If it does eventuate that communication is limited to government-controlled antennae, the paper proposes that the UN should also reserve the right to redact any information received from an alien source, ostensibly to withhold the location of that source and hence prevent butt picture transmissions. But at the same time, really? We're all going to agree that a privileged oligarchy will determine what us plebs should and shouldn't know about whatever the aliens decide to tell us. In any case, the whole premise that an alien civilization will send scout ships out to a multitude of different stellar systems is possible, but it's not actually all that likely, given there's really nothing in it for the aliens to invest in such a massive amount of infrastructure. If they've got the technology to fly AI robot scouts out to lots of stellar systems, they also have the technology to just broadcast the specifications for building a 3D printer and then broadcast specifications to print out the alien AI device, which you could then just put on a table to have a conversation with. Indeed, this is likely to be the preferred solution for an advanced civilization that may have already contacted some nearby neighboring civilizations and received some unreasonably close-up pictures of their anatomy in response. So instead, a galaxy-wide transmission from them could just be saying that if you're smart enough to interpret this message and follow the instructions, then talk to the robot and we'll get back to you if it seems worthwhile.
This is the middle bit.
Whenever we do have first contact, we may need to be prepared for the fact that the aliens won't find us nearly as interesting as we find them, if we're just their latest contact and not their first. To estimate just how many alien civilizations there might be out there, we do have the Drake equation, but occasionally someone throws a curveball. For example,
Dear Cheap Astronomy, what is the ultraviolet habitable zone? Current lists of potentially life-bearing exoplanets are determined by them being in their star's circumstellar zone, in which temperatures are just right to allow liquid water to form. Hence, these zones are also known as Goldilocks zones. The other main feature of a potentially life-bearing exoplanet is that it's rocky, which is determined through measurement of the planet's mass and its likely size. So a large mass planet with a small diameter suggests it's rocky rather than gaseous. There is a certain naivety in us expecting to find life on planets that are most like the Earth, where we're assuming that all life in the universe will be like the one and only example that we know of. But at the same time, there is an Occam's razor logic to it. Why chase a bunch of speculative solutions when you know there is one solution that works? But is being rocky and being in the right temperature zone all there is to it? Well, apparently not, according to a June 2023 article by Spinelli et al. In the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. Spinelli et al. Had proposed that you need a minimum level of ultraviolet radiation to generate the photochemical reactions that lead to abiogenesis, that is, life from lifelessness. More specifically, the generation of ribonucleic acid, RNA, from chemical pathways known as cyanosulfidic chemistry, which can also generate proteins and lipids, that is, fats. The key reaction seems to involve UV light acting on hydrogen cyanide, which is composed of hydrogen, carbon and nitrogen, and given that all this happens in an aqueous solvent, that is, water, you also have a source of oxygen nearby. These are the core chemical ingredients of life as we know it. Again, we need to acknowledge we are naively assuming that all life in the universe will follow the same chemical pathways that led to life on Earth, but also, again, it does make sense to look for such environments that might support such chemical pathways, given that we know for a fact that those pathways have generated life at least once. Anyway, putting all this together, you not only need liquid water, which can only happen in a certain temperature range, but you also need a minimum amount of UV radiation to drive abiogenesis, and also you can't have too much UV radiation, since too much has a disruptive effect on biochemistry. So there is actually a definable ultraviolet habitable zone. Can't be too high, can't be too low, it has to be just right. The paper's authors then calculate that for a star to have a circumstellar zone where water can be a liquid and have that zone coincide with its ultraviolet habitable zone, that star needs a minimum surface temperature of at least 3900 Kelvin. On the OBAFGKM scale of stellar colours and surface temperatures, you need at least an orange K star to get that kind of surface temperature. Where M stars at the lower end of the scale are red dwarfs, then there's K stars, and then there's G stars, which are yellow, sun-like stars. After that, you get into a range of two hot stars, where even in the circumstellar temperature zones where water might form, there's still too much UV radiation, which is not only unfriendly to life, but also unfriendly to atmospheres, which would be strongly ionized by the UV radiation, as well as likely being blown away altogether by the stronger stellar winds associated with these hotter stars. So, this paper offers a way of constraining the number of likely exoplanets with life. That is, if we accept its key premise that you need a minimum level of UV radiation to have life. If that is really the case, then the planets around red dwarfs won't actually support life. Noting that exoplanets around red dwarfs are a big chunk of all the exoplanets we've discovered so far, partly because they're easier to detect, but mostly because red dwarfs comprise about 75% of all the stars in the galaxy and probably the universe. Mind you, it could be that although those red dwarf exoplanets are lifeless, they're also habitable, since they are rocky and watery and aren't being blasted by high-energy ionizing radiation. So, perhaps we or someone else could move in without violating the prime directive. Perhaps.
This is the end bit.
So, there you go. Even if the universe isn't overrun by alien civilizations, there will still be alien worlds to discover, and there could be some quite habitable ones out there that just didn't have the right conditions to start their own ecosystem. But that's it for another episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy. If you've got a space science question, or you just have a general disdain for authority figures, please don't send a picture of your butt to cheapastro@gmail.com and we'll respect your position. Thanks for listening. Steve Nerlich, Cheap Astronomy.